Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Packaging Hero podcast. My name is Elisabeth Skura. Today we're revisiting the ever-relevant subject of decarbonisation and reaching net zero from a packaging perspective. And with me to do this today is Sarah Laidler, who is Senior Consultant at the Carbon Trust and also regular guest at Packaging Europe's various panel discussions. And we'll talk about decarbonisation, the UN Treaty to End Plastic Waste and how this ties in with carbon, the impact of different packaging materials and much more as well. Yeah, welcome, Sarah. Thank you for being on the podcast with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And yeah, I thought for those of our listeners who are maybe not familiar with the work of the Carbon Trust, could you quickly introduce yourself and maybe tell me a bit about what the Carbon Trust does and your work there, particularly in the packaging space?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, I'm a senior consultant. I sit primarily in the business services division of Carbon Trust. Carbon Trust is a mission-led organization with the aim to accelerate the move to a decarbonized future. And we work across a whole different bunch of sectors. Myself, primarily, I work across packaging to help them measure carbon footprints, set targets and strategies for decarbonisation, but this can also include other elements such as life cycle assessments of packaging and producing wider reports on the materials such as plastic as well.
Great. Starting from the basics to kind of define what we're talking about, what does decarbonisation actually mean?
Well, broadly speaking, decarbonisation means reducing or eliminating your carbon dioxide emissions to the point that they just don't exist. That's essentially what we're looking at. Whether that be an organization or a product level, to decarbonize means that you're effectively getting rid of and eliminating the impact from an emissions perspective.
On that subject, there's recently been some controversy about carbon and carbon offsetting, not just in the packaging space. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite a general problem, but I think it might be interesting to raise it here. And yeah, there have been claims that it was untrue, unrealistic, or even harmful. I was wondering what your take is on this.
Yeah, it's a really important conversation when you're thinking about offsets versus decarbonisation, because they're very different things, but sometimes it can be miscommunicated to mean exactly the same thing. Whereas if you're focusing on a very ambitious goal such as net zero, and if you're aligning with the SBTI's definition of net zero, you're prioritizing decarbonization first, which means ultimately you're reducing your footprint, whether it's an organization or a product, if you want to look at it on a product scale, you're reducing that by about 90% of all it's worth. And that's the target that you're aiming for. And in that 90%, you're reducing that and eliminating the carbon dioxide emissions associated with that. And only then does offsetting come in any residual emissions that physically cannot be decarbonized any further. They're just emissions that have to exist in order for the organization to continue. And that's when offsetting becomes an option to help sort of achieve that overall net zero status. Mm-hmm. And I can see the controversy across the world in terms of how that works, because if you're just relying on offsetting and not pursuing decarbonization, you're not really tackling the problem of actually reducing the overall impact of whether it's a product or an organization that you have in the market. You're not dealing with reducing your overall impact on overall emissions. You're not reducing your impact within your costs of your energy internally or how much energy you're using efficiently. You're sort of misplacing sort of the efforts to negate the problem rather than actually deal with it.
Yeah, it seems a lot more efficient to actually face the problem head on rather than working around it in various ways. And at the time of recording this podcast, at least the sort of current discussion on the UN Treaty to End Plastic Waste are still ongoing. And obviously the aim is to work out legally binding global rules and comprehensive circular economy messages. And I was wondering, how does this link to the carbon debate?
It links massively to the carbon debate, but I think, well, perhaps I'm biased because I'm coming from a purely carbon perspective, but really, it links hugely, because at the end of the day, plastics are made out of a petrochemical source, which are derivative from oil and gas. They're derivative from a natural fossil fuel that's being used. So the more of plastic that we produce and the more that we're sort of not turning the tap on in terms of single-use plastic and how much we're overusing it, the more carbon we're producing, because we're making more plastic and we're not having a more synchronized or enabled recycling infrastructure to help harness that resource, which is a problem. So plastic is a very useful example of how resource is not captured effectively and circularity isn't embedded as well as it should be. So this plastic treaty debate and the negotiations that have been going on this week have been focusing on sort of the overall reduction. They've also been focusing on the circularity elements as well. And rightly so, because plastic is a very visual reminder that we're overusing resources and it's not being captured effectively. We've seen some of the devastating sort of photos of it in the natural environment. And that's a very visceral image that can sit with a consumer and remind them that that's a problem. Whereas the carbon story behind that is quite simple. The more circular that infrastructure becomes, the less carbon that's overall emitted. So the more that you take sort of recycled content within sort of our PET bottles, the more that you improve the mechanical recycling infrastructure, the more you invest in perhaps in chemical recycling infrastructure to harness that resource will effectively reduce the overall carbon that's coming upstream of just digging for more oil to put more into plastic.
Absolutely, yes. Tying in with that, the Carbon Trust, I understand, worked with Mindaroo on a report on the growth of single-use plastic production, which kind of showed that the reduction part sort of worldwide doesn't quite seem to be working yet. And the report also covers plastic pollution and how these contribute to the climate crisis. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about the key takeaways from this report from the Carbon Trust's perspective.
There's three main takeaways, I should say, from that key report. The first is that we're producing more plastic waste than ever before. That is rising, despite the fact that consumer awareness is very high. We're still producing more than we should be. And the second finding behind that is that it's not just a plastic pollution crisis, also a climate one. So when we measured or helped measure with some partners, with Wood Mackenzie and Mindaroo, the cradle to grave greenhouse gas emissions from single-use plastics in that analysis that we did were the equivalent of the total emissions of the United Kingdom. So it's around 460 million tons of CO2e just on single-use plastic. And all those emissions are coming from the upstream part of the life cycle. The majority of those are coming from that, at least sort of 30 to 40%. And those emission reduction opportunities that exist there are coming from sort of the downstream, because if you're digging more from sort of oil and gas to sort of make those virgin plastic polymers, the more that you can invest and bring recycling content or recycled content rather back into the chain, you're reducing that overall upstream impact, which is a very key finding from the report.
And obviously, we've talked about plastics, but there's obviously lots of different factors and options when it comes to making packaging sustainable. Sort of, there's the fact of recyclability and also compostability or switching to a different material. And there's trade-offs and advantages and disadvantages to all of them. But yeah, I wanted to look a bit closer at the carbon footprint of some of these options, like, for example, when it comes to replacing plastics with paper or using bioplastics instead of fossil-based plastic or using compostable packaging, for example.
Yeah, and it's such a question that we're asked a lot, definitely within sort of life cycle analysis comparatives. Some of the reports that we've got on our website can also lead into this. But in truth, there are so many factors that come into what the right material is. It goes so much further between sort of what the right starting material is to perhaps where you're making it, how it's recycled, how does it break down, and which can lead to a lot of different sort of options that can feed into the discussion of what the right material is. So for instance, different packaging has more significant emissions at different life cycle stages, depending on what material you're using. So virgin aluminium and virgin plastic have lots of large embodied material emissions because they're sort of derivative from sort of a metal, or they're derivative from oil. And paper itself has really large landfill emissions as it breaks down because it releases that methane back into the atmosphere, whereas plastic does not, because it takes ages, like 100 years plus, to actually break down. And non-degradable materials have no direct landfill emissions, but that doesn't account for the new virgin material that's needed to replace the demand for material that wasn't even recycled in the first place, and taking that whole cycle into account. And then you also have another factor which people don't normally sort of take into account, which is where it's made. So the grid carbon intensity of where it's made. One of the studies that we have on the website shows just how important that can be when you compare perhaps aluminium, glass and plastic against each other. Where you're actually making those products matters. So if you're making that in a really carbon intensive, dirty grid, that can alter the footprint quite significantly. Equally, if you're not recycling that or it's sort of going to end of life where perhaps it breaks down the methane in a paper perspective, or perhaps it's just not recycled at all, it's not a captured resource, that also takes that into account. So there's so many factors at play. And that's sort of, well, you'll know as well as I do, that's why sort of the infrastructure to help harness those resources is actually incredibly, incredibly important when it comes into understanding life cycle assessments. And if you think about plastic as sort of perhaps is the one that sort of comes under a lot of scrutiny, as we know, the greenhouse gas emissions from the production and conversion of things like polymers really depend on which plastic you're looking at as well, because plastic, as we know, come in very different different materials. The greenhouse gas emissions from the production and the conversion of polymers vary depending on the polymer considered. So that can range from as little as 2.7 to 6.3 tons of CO2 equivalent per ton of plastics. And the end of life emissions can vary significantly on the disposal option. So incineration is normally the most greenhouse gas intensive per ton of what you're producing. Whereas if you look at it on a landfill, there's no emissions that are coming from landfill apart from the transportation of the landfill, which is very, very small on a ton basis. So all those little elements really do come into it when you're thinking about that sort of life cycle comparison, if you're just looking at the overall material. And then if you then add another player into the conversation, which is your compostable packaging, that also opens a whole range of sort of issues, challenges, and also, I guess, enable us to sort of help bridge the gap between us using less plastics and moving to more sort of perhaps bio-based materials. But I think when it comes to compostable, we also have to consider that it's still a single-use product. Like, you can't argue that, whether we're sort of using it as compostable or not, you're still not really capturing that resource. It's still going back in the ground or perhaps back in sort of anaerobic digestion. And also it tends to consume a lot more energy and produce more emissions than recycled or reused alternatives, depending on sort of the data that you're looking at. And it can currently sometimes be broken down in terms of industrial composting facilities, which I don't think a lot of consumers know. I know myself, like when you've had a plastic compostable cup, you sort of look at it and think there's just no way that this is going to break down in my garden bin. It doesn't make sense looking at it. And 9 times out of 10, it won't, because they're not communicating to you effectively that it is compostable under an industrial process where the temperatures and the humidity and the sort of soil composition is tailored. So it will break down in an industrial compost and not the same as sort of you just throw it in the garden. It won't disintegrate in front of your eyes. And that's really important to take into consideration. And although data is patchy, there are some life cycle assessments that can say it can sometimes have higher environmental impacts than non-compostable alternatives. And with that, you sort of get into a lot of sort of discussions around whether that's a greenwashing sort of consideration to take into account. Communication is really key when it comes down to compostable or bio-based packaging. A consumer has to understand whether they actually can compost that at home or not, and which bin to put that in. It's really important. But I must say, like, closed loop systems when it comes to compostable packaging or perhaps sort of a bio-based compostable alternative, they can really work, and they can work in ideal applications, but they have to be taken into account where it can work. So for instance, like an example of a festival or a sports event with food vendors, if you're using compostable packaging with uneaten food scraps, they can all go into one bin and then go off to anaerobic digestion if you don't have other waste streams that are polluting that environment. That's quite a closed loop good system to have. That's you're collecting the resource, and that's also negating sort of any sort of plastic that doesn't necessarily need to be there. So it's really important not to demonize any sort of specific packaging type, because they all have their for and against arguments, but they all just have to work in the right scenario. So converting everything to plastic that's recycled until the end of time isn't ideal, because we're still using a lot of virgin plastics to sort of produce that amount. Making everything compostable won't work either, because there's not actually a lot of widespread infrastructure and closed loop systems to deal with that effectively either. So it has to be tread with caution, which is why like the conversations that the UN Treaty are having are really impactful, both on a sort of a climate scale, but also in terms of feasibility and who's going to sort of invest and have be able to have this infrastructure to support these new goals.
Yeah, it looks like a really complex sort of topic, obviously, but I guess doing detailed research into what's needed or what's right for one particular kind of product or scenario is obviously really time well spent, I would imagine.
For sure. And there's definitely other forums that are looking into also wider LCAs of key materials. So a good discussion I had, I think it was one of the Packaging Europe events, actually, that in the plastic life cycle assessment that most organizations will do and follow the same calculations like us and others, they'll look at the cradle to grave scenario of a plastic. And if it goes sort of a landfill, it has no emissions because it doesn't break down. Likewise, if it sort of ends up floating in the sea, that's the same output as you get if it goes to a landfill. But what you don't calculate or you don't take into the methodology if it ends up in a natural environment is the carbon that's affected sort of in that wider scale. So if that, I know perhaps it's a bit dramatic to focus on one plastic cup, but if that plastic cup ends up in the sea, that plastic cup is then eaten by, broken down by plankton, or it's broken down by a sea creature. And then that disrupts like a food chain, or it disrupts sort of a fishing colony, or it disrupts sort of lots and lots of plastic cups disrupt where fishing was done previously. That's not taken into account anywhere. And that's a really important part. And that's the visual picture that we see with plastic pollution and perhaps other packaging pollution as well, because the system isn't acting fast enough to harness all of these resources and take them into a circular system. So that's another very important piece to consider in terms of when we're doing these research and we're understanding the life cycle assessments, how are we measuring that wider impact?
Absolutely, yes. And I wanted to take a slight detour and take a wider view, because I understand that you've worked quite a lot in Asia, for example, in Singapore with the Carbon Trust. And obviously, we look a lot at Europe and maybe the US here, sometimes at other countries. But I thought it would be interesting to get your take on what differences around packaging and packaging waste have you observed in places such as Singapore? And what have you noticed there? What works and what doesn't?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, working in Singapore was a delight, I must say, straight up. I love Singapore. I'll talk about how much I love Singapore until the cows come home. But I must say, part of the reason that I loved it is because it is just generally built on greener policies, like as a city itself, which is also sort of trickles down their waste legislation. So the default for their waste is to be incinerated, either with an energy recovery or without, or it goes to a recycling stream. And plastics are still the largest, from the research that I did, still the largest category of waste disposed of in Singapore, according to the National Environment Agency. And only about 6% of that is actually recycled. That's lower than the sort of overall global average, which was about 9% last time I checked. And that shows that plastic has also increased per capita over the last sort of 15 to 20 years. So that plastic's getting bigger and bigger, and the recycling figures are not going up with that, which is showing it a bit of a problem. And like, yeah, while I was there, I mean, there's lots and lots of plastic in general, because there's wonderful things like Hawker food centers, which have great sort of takeaway facilities, and you get to try all these wonderful foods, and at least in my experience, and they come with a lot of plastic packaging, and that plastic packaging isn't necessarily harnessed like sort of on street bins, etc., like that. So there's doesn't seem to be sort of a big push in terms of recycling infrastructure that has sort of helped create that circularity, more in terms of just sort of an energy recovery, which we know is not really circular or solving sort of an overall infrastructure problem. And on top of that, whilst I was there, you did see a lot of new vendors going for compostable alternatives or like paper-based alternatives, which is really good to see. However, there's no infrastructure to take that away from me as the consumer, or put it in an anaerobic digestion or a separate food waste outlet that it can go. So again, it comes down to sort of making sure that infrastructure is in place to support what is being put on the market. So if there is more plastic going up every single year in Singapore, and I think there's a crazy figure such as, I think it's like 13 bags of rubbish per person a day in Singapore, which is very, very high. That infrastructure needs to be there to sort of support that system. If it is going to stay with plastic, or if they're going to go for compostable, there needs to be a industrial compost waste stream that it's all going to, which it doesn't seem to sort of be to be near.
Yeah, it's interesting sometimes to look a bit further afield and see how things are done there. I've noticed I've just been on holiday in Japan, which I love telling people about, but I've noticed they still use a lot more plastics generally than in Europe. They're still, I think it's gone a little bit less, but things are still often kind of double and triple wrapped. I think it's sort of, they focus on the convenience, but obviously it's quite strange to see when you're sort of used to the plastic reduction. And there seems to be good recycling in place, but I gather also quite a lot of incineration. And yeah, it'd be interesting to look at the statistics there, but that's a subject for another another podcast.
Yeah, I'm sure. But I must say, like, just because perhaps the UK is using less plastic, doesn't mean that we're sort of not investing more in infrastructure to recycle the ones that we already have. So it's definitely, I mean, I've been watching this UN treaty like a hawk to see what's going on. I'm so jealous I wasn't there. But that's why it's so important, because if these all countries are agreeing together, it's so fascinating, because they all have such different infrastructure and such different investment priorities for where it's going and how they're going to, I'm just very fascinated to see how they're going to prioritize managing plastic pollution, whilst also they're going to have to fulfill investment in infrastructure to actually get it over the line. I've said this before, there's normally a tug of war between sort of designing plastic out versus recycling it. And it's very much not a choice, at least from my perspective. They both need to happen in order to solve this problem. And it will demand countries to have more unified infrastructure systems and give that investment that's needed for so many years.
Absolutely, yes. So fingers crossed it will yield real results, because it's such an important thing that really need to get on with everywhere. I wanted to conclude this podcast by asking you, obviously, because it's such a complex subject, what advice would you give to our listeners across the packaging value chain, from packaging manufacturers to brand owners, the first or best steps to decarbonize their value chain?
Yeah, the first thing that you always have to start with is understanding the footprint. That's the 101, is understanding where your hotspots are, where do you know that your emissions are lying, understanding whether there's a target that you can put on that as an organization. Ideally, we all should be setting sort of net zero targets and aiming for those ambitious reductions in order to achieve that 1.5 degree world that's desperately needed to be capped at, and then following that, it's working in terms of understanding what's feasible in the short term versus the long term. So if you understand, in terms of a packaging value chain, depending on what material you're starting with, but let's, for hypothetical sake, say that it's a plastic packaging company, most of your emissions, depending on where you sit in the plastic value chain, are going to be upstream and going to be coming from that sort of virgin plastic source that you have, from monomer to polymer to what you're putting out as the final product. That's where your hotspot emissions are going to be. So understanding sort of which suppliers that you're working with that can perhaps grant you more recycled content to sort of negate the virgin plastic that might be coming from that. If you're then sort of selling that on perhaps as a preform to another company, if you're selling that to customers that perhaps are embedding more renewable energy or energy efficiency to reduce your footprint further down, and understanding as well sort of what, I guess, aligning a policy, aligning what is going to be expected of you in terms of your perhaps recycled content, perhaps the recycling commitments that are in the country, perhaps the recycling commitments that will be aligned with your business, and understanding that it's all well and good sort of putting a product on the market that is compostable, but if you're selling it in an area or selling it in a vicinity that doesn't have it, that's not going to work. And that's sort of still within your scope three, because you still need to take an end of life into account of what you're putting out onto the market. So really understanding feasibly what's within your control, what you can influence quickly, and what's going to give you the most greater impact is sort of the basic things to do when you're looking at decarbonizing. And overall, it takes collaboration and a lot of guts to go forward with it in general. Decarbonizing is not easy, but decarbonizing is extremely needed in order to meet the climate goals that we're aiming at, what, 1.5 degree world.
Absolutely, yes. Hopefully, maybe some people who've listened today feel inspired to maybe do a bit more, and also maybe collaborate a bit more, because it seems pretty much any kind of discussion we have on Packaging Europe, it comes down to like how important collaboration is. So definitely an important thing. So that brings us to the end of today's conversation and podcast. That just leaves me to say thank you very much, Sarah, for being here today and for speaking to me.
No problem. My pleasure. Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you. And thank you very much for listening in as well. So make sure you subscribe to our podcast so that you don't miss any of the latest episodes. Thank you very much, everybody. Goodbye.